Okay, welcome back from lunch, everybody. We'll start the afternoon session. The first session that we have today is Progress in Intractable Cancers. Today we're going to focus on heme malignancies. Tomorrow we'll focus on solid tumors. And we have maybe the smallest panel of the day, only three people, but a lot of topics to cover in heme malignancies. I'll introduce the panelists in a couple minutes, but I just wanted to give a brief overview of the space and quickly hand it over to our excellent expert panel. As many of you know, heme malignancies are really, you know, a bunch of rare disorders in the main. Most of them are orphan designated patient populations. And the last look that I looked last night at the 2016 World Health Organization update to the classification of hematological malignancies, lymphoid and myeloid malignancies, when I counted it up, it came to about 175 clinically distinct diseases, and much of that is by incorporating what we have learned about genetic information and incorporating the molecular features of that into identifying patient populations that have distinct disease courses. On the right-hand side, just a quick little graphic looking across the space to look and see how the different malignancies or associated with different hematological forms. Thanks to the analysts that actually put these slides together last night. I'm just getting to look at them now. But based on, and Vishalini, I think Akash is not here, but Vishalini is over here. So, so just using SEER data to look at, age of incidence, 5-year overall mortality, the size of the bubble is the new incidence, new cases diagnosed each year. We see there's been tremendous progress in the years for certain forms, particularly pediatric ALL, which is, as on this right-hand side, you can see that really the transformation has been really driven by incremental sort of advancement of understanding how to use combination chemotherapies, steroids, and anti-metabolite therapies in combination, and now having new targeted therapies like Abl kinase inhibitors, and now maybe what's even advancing the survival potentially for relapse refractory patients is the advent of bispecific T-cell engagers and CAR T-cell therapies. But in other cases, we've had, dramatic transformations of outcomes of patients based on, really one drug class coming in, such as Gleevec for BCR ABL in CML, and the development of arsenic trioxide and all trans retinoic acid for APL. However, there's still, a lot of unmet need. We do have, if we could just go back here, we do have, because there's been such advancement in either maintaining patients sort of in a chronic, condition on drug therapies and mostly in, CLL and more indolent lymphomas. We do see a growing prevalent population, also the myeloma space, because of all the progress there, and we'll get into that in a little bit, that there's a growing prevalent population there as well. So we have a really changing landscape of heme malignancies in patients that have been either, more accurately molecularly characterized or have benefit from all these advances in drug therapies. When we look at the market commercially, about 35% of the market today is represented by heme malignancies. And remember, that by epidemiology, it's only maybe 10% of new cancer diagnoses. So it's contributed a lot to the oncology market, not only in success of oncology franchises, but also in bringing novel drug classes. Many of them have been first approved in blood cancers. If you look at by indication on the right-hand side, multiple myeloma has really been a very fruitful space for bringing new drug classes into patients and really showing the benefit of providing multiple lines of therapies, maintenance therapies, you know, combinations of novel agents that have really continually, and we should actually go back, Ken, and you know, redo this slide with myeloma and figure out how, you know, it's really advanced the standard of care. But you know, so that shows the advance, but it also kind of shows the challenges to the cost of the healthcare system and you know, what this means that, you know, relatively rare, you know, patient population now is driving so much value to the, so much cost to the healthcare system. when we look at the leading drug classes, Revlimid is right now the top-selling oncology drug, followed by Rituxan. Rituxan is becoming replaced by biosimilars in the not-too-distant future, increasingly. So that's likely to drop off of this. But we have ibrutinib coming up and replacing that, as well as CD38 antibody Darzalex. So still, we see heme malignancies driving a lot of the leading drug classes in the value of the oncology market. In the pipeline, we see about, you know, a quarter of the pipeline intensities focus on heme malignancies. Still, many of the programs are looking across the more prevalent solid tumors. And when we look at drug development by stage, about half the pipeline is in this sort of, you know, peri-proof of concept space where they're in phase two and trying to figure out how to demonstrate value and think about how to prioritize the indications and move forward for you know, what is it going to be, a you know, their approval strategy and whatnot. Or if you know, indeed the, you know, the data doesn't look like it's supportive of you know, further development. So a lot of things that are sort of in this space where soon they'll read out and we'll figure out how much of an impact they might have, you know, in the upcoming years. And as far as the pipeline activity, again, it's mostly focused on the more prevalent heme malignancies. You know, a lot of things aren't represented, you know, on this graphic that are or smaller patient populations. You know, T-cell lymphomas, leukemias are well underrepresented as far as, you know, development activity. Pediatric ALL has been a very, you know, fruitful space, as we discussed, and there's still a lot of, you know, many things, you know, and many of these might even be, you know, CAR T-cells and whatever that are in development for it. I'm going to turn it over to panel, but first, the last thing I want to say is I used something similar to this in the earlier CAR T-cell deal space, where all these deals here, again, come up in the top deals in the heme malignancy space. They were almost exclusively focused on T-cell therapies. So I will stop there and transition to the panel. And first, I would like to invite Dr. Ken Anderson from Dana-Farber to talk about plasma cell disorders. And basically, what we're going to do is we're going to walk through plasma cell disorders. We'll talk about myeloid disorders, and then we'll talk about lymphoma. And what we would like to do is sort of walk away with sort of a map in mind of, you know, here are the areas, the challenges that, you know, our oncologists, you know, face every day, what they see in developing new therapies, and what might be on the horizon about how different unmet needs of blood cancers might be addressed with these efforts. So, Ken?
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. So I'm going to go quickly through what's going on in myeloma with at least my interpretation of the state of where we are and what might be the most exciting things to get things better. we're blessed because, as everyone in the room knows, we have IMIDs, we have proteasome inhibitors, an HDAC inhibitor, and antibodies. Worked in the preclinical, worked in clinical trials, now universally used, and the median survival has actually improved at least 3 to 4-fold for myeloma. It's actually should be 22 FDA approvals now. But because we have these medicines that are efficacious and advanced and active myeloma and well tolerated, they have been moved earlier in the disease course. So we have no longer wait for calcium, kidney, anemia, and bone disease to develop. We actually treat patients earlier who have 60% plasma cells or have an aberrant kappa lambda ratio or who have bone lesions on sensitive imaging. They're now being treated. The reason I mention that is the idea here is with novel therapies, we can potentially prevent active myeloma from occurring. That's never would I have thought we could talk about prevention. So at ASH last year, there were vaccine trials such as this one, peptide-based vaccines, to try to prevent patients with early smoldering myeloma from getting active disease. There was a trial of Darzalex that you just heard about, a monoclonal antibody with the same goal to try to prevent active myeloma from developing. And then there was even a very aggressive stem cell transplant treatment to try to avoid evolution from smoldering myeloma to active disease. I will just tell you, no slide, but when you sequence patients with early stage smoldering multiple myeloma, the majority of the changes are already there. So these patients are just having primarily a clonal expansion. So the idea to treat them earlier is actually quite relevant. Now, when patients actually get active myeloma, we use the combinations of these agents together. And the reason we do it is pretty much everybody responds. 3/4 get a very good partial response and half get a complete response, including minimal residual disease negativity. So for example, an IMID, immunomodulatory drug lenalidomide, you just heard about, a proteasome inhibitor, bortezomib and dexamethasone, very common regimen. We use this in old people, the same combinations of agents, but sometimes we attenuate the dose and schedule. So RVD, Revlimid, Velcade, Dex, and the transplant candidates, RVD light, sort of like Bud Light or Miller Light in the older patients. So when we use RVD, for example, as an induction treatment, in patients who have satisfactory end organ function and are of a sufficient age as well, they undergo a stem cell transplant. That's the standard of practice. But in the era of all these new drugs, is stem cell transplant still adding value? So we did this trial of RVD drugs only with an early transplant or not, and published this with our French colleagues in the New England Journal. And the point here is that the transplant still actually has value because the extent and frequency of response is higher, RVD plus transplant. But look at what's so important there. 2/3 of the patients got MRD negativity with drugs alone and 80% with drugs and a transplant. We never used to be able to get MRD negativity previously. And at ASH last year, my colleague Hervé from France showed that if you get fewer than 1 in a million myeloma in normal in marrow cells, MRD negativity at the level of 10 to the minus 6, it correlates with a positive outcome. So what you're seeing now in myeloma is clinical trials that are trying to define the value of MRD. If you get treated and you don't make MRD, should you switch treatment? If you have a transplant and you're not MRD negative, should you get consolidation? Perhaps the most important question of all, if you're on maintenance therapy, can you stop maintenance therapy a la CML experience if you become MRD negative? Now, if 3 drugs are better, maybe if 3 are good, maybe 4 are better. So daratumumab has been added to the proteasome inhibitor lenalidomide-dex combination. We don't know yet the results of the trial, but 4 drugs have been tested in the transplant group. And 4 drugs have been tested also, daratumumab, added in the elderly population. So far, I would say we need to have the results of randomized trials before we add in quite expensive monoclonal antibodies to what's already an expensive triplet of targeted treatments. Once we treat people, we use the same agents for maintenance. This is lenalidomide maintenance in standard risk myeloma, high risk, and ultra high risk genetic categories of myeloma. Lenalidomide adds value. It's FDA approved because the progression-free and overall survival is better with the use of lenalidomide. And we also have the son of bortezomib, an oral proteasome inhibitor that's being tested in maintenance strategies. And here is depicted from the left to the right. You have high response rates, and the extent of response goes up as people take this oral proteasome inhibitor with time. Right now, the standard is to continue maintenance until progression. And then myeloma still has the nerve to relapse, and we use these same drugs, but we use second-generation proteasome inhibitor like Kyprolis, second-generation immunomodulatory drug like pomalidomide, or we add in a monoclonal antibody like daratumumab. And that actually turns out to add value. If you say to me, why is it that patients with myeloma have a median progression-free survival that's approaching 7 to 10 years now, the reason is they respond and they can have quite a nice response to their initial therapy. And then when they relapse, their overall survival can be much longer because, for example, on this slide, Kyprolis lenalidomide dexamethasone at 4 years is adding an 8-month survival advantage. So there's 4 or 5 years more when you get Kyprolis in the regimen. Similarly here, a monoclonal antibody, elotuzumab, in the maintenance strategy together with lenalidomide dex, an overall survival advantage at 4 years. So it's no longer a death sentence when patients get relapsed myeloma. Not only that, we can get MRD negativity even in relapsed disease. This is daratumumab, the CD38 antibody, together with lenalidomide dex. And on the right-hand side, you can see that we get MRD negativity, fewer than 1 in 100,000 or 1 in a million, myeloma normal, and it correlates with outcome, just as it did in newly diagnosed, so it does here in relapsed disease. We're going to have sub-Q daratumumab soon. So what's new, and then I'm just going to finish. Here's a new CD38 antibody. You might say, why do we need any more CD38 antibodies? Well, on the left-hand side, there's a novel mechanism for this isatuximab antibody, a direct killing one that daratumumab doesn't have. We'll find out in the clinic whether it's efficacious or not. But I can tell you the phase 3 trial for this antibody is already completed, so we will know relatively soon whether we'll get another antibody in our armamentarium in myeloma. BCMA, I think, is a better antigen, at least target antigen in myeloma, than CD38 or even the SLAMF7, the target for elotuzumab. It's very selective to normal and abnormal plasma cells, also present on dendritic cells. We evaluated an immunotoxin to BCMA a couple of years ago. It has its immune activities on the right, but it also delivers an auristatin toxin and kills the cell on the left. And at ASH last year, this drug conjugate was given fast track by the FDA because 60% of people responded with advanced myeloma with a duration of 8 months, and this is now going forward towards approval. As in ALL and in lymphomas, so we in myeloma are jealous and we're trying to do the BiTEs, where you can link to BCMA and bring the immune system, theoretically anyway, locally, and in so doing, enhancing efficacy and decreasing toxicity. These are in clinical trials, several of them, and time will tell. But you had a session this morning on CAR T cells, and I'll just finish with this little discussion here. In myeloma, there have been multiple in the past and ongoing trials of CAR T cells. CD19 CAR T cells have been tried. CD19, honestly, is not expressed, perhaps on the progenitor cell, as Bill Matsui will tell you, but not on most myelomas. 2 of 10 patients treated actually had a longer response to their CAR T cells than they had had to their prior therapy before going on the protocol. Here are the different targets that have been used, CD138, which is Syndican. BCMA is the most common. There are multiple trials in the United States and one from China. And I just want to tell you about two of them. One is the 2121 trial that Stan knows all about. This is the vector with BCMA. The co-stimulatory molecule is 4-1BB. Preclinically, it worked very well. And the trial was a dose escalation of T cells with pretreatment with fludarabine and Cytoxan, and 24 people harvested, 21 treated, and what was presented at ASH is shown here, 94% overall response, very impressive, extent of response, some cytokine release syndrome. What we need to see here is more durability in this and other trials. There is a global trial open for enrollment that may very well lead to approval. The other one is from Carl June and his colleagues at Penn, together with Novartis. Cytoxan pretreatment, this time again with a BCMA CAR, and they showed that on the right-hand side of this slide, people do better with pretreatment, and they do better with more cells. So if you pretreat and you give higher doses, on the right-hand side, you get more responses. And the summary of their experience is right here. About half of the patients responded, and duration, again, it remains to be defined. And finally, what about precision medicine? I was listening to the panel, last panel this morning. Well, in myeloma, we have lots of mutations. This particular slide, by the size of the letters, is the frequency of the mutations. The RAS-RAF-MAP kinase pathway is most commonly implicated, and others have tried to target it with RAF, MEK inhibitors, ERK inhibitors. Honestly speaking, there's just transient responses. But the first example, in my opinion, of personalized medicine in myeloma is right here, venetoclax. You know about it in CLL, and you know about it in lymphoma. In myeloma, in the 11-14 translocation patients whose tumor overexpresses BCL2 gene and protein, the response rates here, together with a proteasome inhibitor, are 90% in relapsed disease. So this is coming to a clinic near you. And my final slide is, I heard very nice, elegant discussions about profiling and stuff this morning. In myeloma, as you know, we repeatedly do bone marrow aspirations and biopsies to assess the disease. What I believe is coming is cell-free DNA and single-cell sequencing, either alone or perhaps in combination. But here's one example from our institution where cell-free DNA from Jens Lohr's work has been used to detect myeloma, and not only that, to determine clonal composition of myeloma in the peripheral blood and be a very good reflection of the bone marrow. It needs much more work. My final thing is this. I do think the future of myeloma is we're going to use combinations of agents that we will have informed preclinically. They will be used in profiled subsets of patients with biomarkers. So we're not going to be doing big clinical trials anymore. Small clinical trials which will show efficacy or not in a much more expeditious way, saving costs, and most importantly, getting to patients quickly. It will take amazing collaborations, which we've been blessed with myeloma. But my strong feeling is we can get, and we will get, to MRD with drugs and or transplant or CAR T cells or other approaches. But to me, that isn't enough. I believe we have to fix the host immunity in order to really not only get MRD, but to have it persist and approach potential cure. So I think I'll just stop right there.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. Next, I would like to invite Stan Frank from Celgene to talk about myeloid malignancies.
So if you remember the slide Mike showed you, there was this set of bubbles all the way over to the left. And that was the group that had the lowest percentage of 5-year survival. So if you think about these intractable hematologic malignancies, Ken and I were debating that big purple blob for myeloma probably needs to move about 20% for the median, because it showed a median or 40% 5-year survival, which we don't think is really the current state. But unfortunately for the myeloid diseases, we haven't moved the needle as much. And so I want to just give you how the Celgene franchise is viewing how we are making investments and trying to address these intractable myeloid diseases. And it starts with two agents that are approved. Revlimid is approved in deletion 5q MDS, and Vidaza is approved in the US for MDS, but also in Europe for elderly AML. And we have recently added in the last year another new targeted therapy for the 6-7% of patients that have a mutation in the isocitrate dehydrogenase 2 gene, or IDH2, and that's a IDFA, which leads to a different paradigm in leukemia, where there's a differentiation out of the clone, and actually it's fairly remarkable because you can still detect cells with the mutation, but the patients have normal counts and prolonged survival. So that's going through additional registration trials now. But I want to talk about what we've brought into the franchise and start really with luspatercept. And luspatercept is a different class of agent. It is actually not attacking the malignant clone, but it is an erythroid maturation agent that's targeting the debilitating symptoms and the need for transfusions in these myeloid diseases. And there are two trials that are ongoing that we'll be reading out later this year. The first is in myelodysplastic syndrome called MEDALIST, and the other is in beta thalassemia, which we won't talk about today, called BELIEVE. But we're also attacking that other very high unmet need, which is myelofibrosis, and that would be the COMMANDS trial. So I want to give you a little bit of an introduction to luspatercept. So this is looking at the TGF beta superfamily. And what we have is an activin B receptor 2 that signals through SMAD that ultimately leads to changes in transcription and blood cell production. So that's the idea here, is this activin receptor 2B is what we want to have as the target. So this is luspatercept is a novel recombinant protein that binds the ligands for this TGF-beta superfamily. So there's a modified extracellular domain of the receptor shown in red, and then a human IgG1 Fc domain. So you have this modified fusion protein that you're administering. And the idea is that then traps the ligands and restores erythropoiesis and normal maturation. So this is the animated version of this. Luspatercept competes for the receptor, and by doing so, erythroid differentiation is not blocked. So we can think of the early stages of red cell development as being erythropoietin dependent, and we're really looking at a more maturation stage. So this is not the same as giving erythropoietin, inducing this later stage of maturation. Well, the discovery of this agent and its potential role and that led to these clinical studies was actually fairly serendipitous. And Acceleron, our partner for luspatercept development, was exploring this class of agents mostly for inflammatory diseases. And so they did a normal healthy volunteer study, and they gave one or two doses. And there was a remarkable side effect pattern, and that was that these patients developed marked increases in their hemoglobin in a dose-dependent fashion. So the development of the drugs shifted from treating inflammatory diseases to looking at myelodysplastic syndrome and beta thalassemia. And in these two phase two studies, there was marked increases in hemoglobin, a decrease in transfusion burden, and in some cases rendering a patient's transfusion independent with sustained responses. And so that, you know, has now led to the BELIEVE study in beta thal to look for what this might do. So this is now the phase two data in myelodysplastic syndrome, and what you can see is there's hematologic improvement in a large proportion of patients. It occurs across erythropoietin levels, which is used to determine whether you might want to supplement these myelodysplastic syndrome patients with EPO. It's dosed every 3 weeks and can be continued on in up to 5 years in extension studies. So I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about another unmet need, and that's the myeloproliferative neoplasms. And they're shown in the dark blue box there. So we do pretty well now against BCR-ABL mutated lesions with multiple TKIs that have activity. But what we don't really have are effective agents for all of the patients who have myeloproliferative disorders, and in particular, primary myelofibrosis. So these are BCR-ABL1 negative. There are three sort of flavors: primary myelofibrosis, polycythemia vera, and essential thrombocythemia, or ET. Now, this is a high prevalence set of diseases. There's 1 to 3 people per 100,000 that are diagnosed with a myeloproliferative neoplasm myelofibrosis in the U.S. and in Europe, and so you have prevalences of over 30,000 patients. We have learned over the last 15 to 20 years that mutations in the Janus kinase system and JAK2 are important in driving this. And so shown here are 3 of the signaling pathways that impinge on JAK2 and then JAK2 signaling through STAT. So there can be V16, 17F, or exon 12 mutations that can now be used to diagnose this disease. And this abnormal signaling through both JAK2 and JAK1 can lead to a combination of ineffective hematopoiesis and inflammatory cytokines, giving you anemia, extramedullary hematopoiesis, which manifests itself as splenomegaly, and then a series of constitutional symptoms, primarily from the fatigue or from hepato or splenomegaly. Now, the survival for this population is relatively poor, and they can be broken down in the risk groups based upon clinical symptoms as well as different molecular abnormalities. But if you look at the sort of bottom right of this, the bottom red part of the high-risk group, you're looking at a median survival of 1.3 years. So we'd like to modify the disease. We'd also like to attack the symptoms, and we think that having now luspatercept, we can go after some of the symptomatic relief, but that won't be modifying the disease. So the question is, what else can we do to modify the disease? And these are sort of the treatment algorithms today. And we really only have one approved agent in the JAK class. A second one may be coming, but this is ruxolitinib. And so ruxolitinib may have indications across the risk groups, but for patients who have failed ruxolitinib, there are not a significant number of good options available. So earlier this year, we acquired Impact Biosciences and a drug known as fedratinib, which also is a specific JAK2 inhibitor. And we did so driven by data from a trial that's been reported by Harrison et al. Last year called Jakarta-2. And this enrolled patients with primary post-polycythemia vera or post-ET myelofibrosis who had platelet counts over 50,000. They had received ruxolitinib for at least 2 weeks, and they had a washout period before starting the new agent, fedratinib. So just to orient you, the red is those that were truly resistant to prior ruxolitinib exposure. The blue are the intolerant, and then the others were primarily patients who had lower platelet counts. And what you can see is across the different patient spectrums, there is a predominance in this waterfall plot of decreases in splenomegaly and improvement in symptoms when fedratinib was applied in this ruxolitinib failed or refractory population. So we are making a big play now in this myelofibrosis space with an incidence in the U.S. of about 17,000 patients. We think this translates into about a $4 billion market opportunity. We're going first to take this highly selective JAK2 inhibitor into patients where they have failed or refractory to ruxolitinib. The NDA is planned for later this year. There are ongoing discussions that were updated on our earnings call on Friday with the FDA to make sure we've got all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And in addition to bringing in fedratinib, we are running the COMMANDS study to address the anemia, and we think the combination of these two active agents in a very high unmet need population will offer great promise to patients. So we can skip this one and this one, in the interest of time. So there is great hope that as fedratinib is now rapidly entering the Celgene portfolio, that we will really have a new option for these patients with primary or secondary myelofibrosis that have failed other agents. So I think we'll pass it over to Bill.
Thanks, Dan. So next I'd like to invite Bill Matsui. And where are you now?
I am still at Hopkins. So I've been at Hopkins for years, and I am going to be there for another month, and then I'm moving to Austin, Texas, actually. and doing something different than some. So what I thought I would do today is is talk about sort of a very, very broad way of viewing lymphoma and sort of where the areas of unmet need are, how we sort of take care of patients now, and where should we go in the future. So this is really a way to just sort of very easily organize, I think, lymphoma. So the one way out on the left, which is Hodgkin's, that's one that is pretty highly curable. That's one of the first cancers that was actually ever cured. There are sort of two flavors of that, but most of the patients have classical Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you can split them out into really sort of their clinical behavior. And so you have indolent lymphomas. The sort of the king of that group is follicular lymphoma. It's very common. In aggressive lymphomas, the sort of the most common lymphoma overall is diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And then you have these highly aggressive lymphomas, which are actually pretty, they're on the rare side, which is good because they are very aggressive. So, you know, as time has gone on, there have been about 10 ways of classifying lymphoma. There have been a million ways to permutate that. And I think that actually the easiest way to do it is to do it just by how they sort of clinically act. So what are our expectations for each group? So in the indolent group, let's take follicular lymphoma as the sort of the standard. The current treatment paradigm I have here is that you know, you want to treat the patients because they have some issue, right? So these are chronic diseases. A lot of times patients will present with lymphoma. They'll have a mass, they'll get it biopsied, it'll be follicular lymphoma. They'll come to see me or one of us and we'll say, look, you know, I'm not gonna do anything. We shouldn't do anything, we should just wait. And people oftentimes are super shocked by that because they say, well, I just got diagnosed with cancer and now you're not gonna do anything about it. So one question is that that's always been pervasive in the field is that these things are so indolent, they grow so slowly, whether or not you should treat them right when they present or whether you should treat them when they actually run into symptoms. And so there's a big parallel between treating something like smoldering myeloma and active myeloma. So we tended to treat patients who have active disease. So it's either that it's in a place where you don't want it to be or they have systemic symptoms from that. So really the first thing to decide is whether you're gonna treat the patient or not. If you're gonna go ahead and treat the patient, most of the time everything centers around using a monoclonal antibody like rituximab. So you use Rituxan, you can combine it with a number of different chemotherapeutic agents. Most people tend to use bendamustine these days. And then once you induce a remission, it's highly responsive to chemotherapy, but like all indolent diseases, it's not curable with standard chemotherapy. So one way to try to prolong remissions would be to do maintenance. And so maintenance has been shown to, with anti-CD20, has been shown to improve progression-free survival, but its impact on overall survival is less clear, right? So if you think about it, you have someone, you give them chemo, now you're gonna give an antibody, it's well tolerated, you're making money by giving it, should you do it or not, right? Because the options are you give it and you can wait a little bit longer, although you're treating the patient, or you wait for them to relapse and then you just treat them again, right? So it's, I think there's a difference in philosophies about maintenance or not. So I'm a person who actually doesn't do maintenance. I actually watch people and then I wait for them to relapse. Radioimmunotherapy has been used more less and less over the years. I think that there's some interesting reasons why that might be the case. And then since the disease is incurable, like all chronic things, MDS, myeloma, these chronic malignancies are incurable with standard chemotherapy. When you relapse, you give them chemo again. And of late, there are two targeted agents. One is Zidelic, the other is capanalisib, which are PI3 kinase inhibitors. One is oral, the other is IV. They have different toxicity profiles, which is pretty interesting. Between those, I think that there's no clear winner between the two, but that can be given, both of them can be given for patients who've been through at least two other therapies. And then in the end, you can also try transplantation. So that's sort of where we are. So you go around and around in the relapse salvage setting. So what can we do to try to make things better? Where are the strategies? So because of the success of rituximab, there are a whole host of other antibodies that target CD20. There are other antigens on the cell surface of B cells, being CD19 and CD22, which are also can be targeted. And then you have a whole host of sort of other targets that people have identified. So really within binding antigens, really the strategy, and Ken had touched on this, really is to use either a naked antibody that's been used predominantly in the disease. You can start making antibody drug conjugates, so those are starting to enter the clinic. You can make bispecific antibodies. Those have been developed for ALL, and so they're trying to get into lymphoma. And then you can now go sort of to the, you know, sell the farm, and you can go to CAR T cells. So once you have antigens, then I think you can go through these strategies. I think that the most important thing is that what is the quality of your antigen, actually? So are you going to get a lot of off-target activity? Is, you know, if you have an antigen which is not necessary for the survival of the cell, then the cell is going to just stop expressing it, right? And it's going to survive. So in choosing antigens, I think that's where the strategy really lies. Can you find an antigen which is critical, and can you target that antigen in a way that is safe? Because most antigens that are very critical are critical for many things, not just B cells. So, you know, there are examples like CD19, where in ALL and large cell lymphoma with CAR T cells, you have antigen loss that happens in a number of cases, and that's how CAR T cell escape happens for those two diseases. So besides cell surface targeting, what are other things? So there is a lot of interest. There's always been a lot of interest in how do you affect signaling pathways. And so there's been a lot of interest in targeting B cell receptor signaling. So that would be BTK signaling, PI3 kinase, which we have, and then also spleen tyrosine kinase, or SYK. So SYK inhibitors were actually just approved for as sort of an immune modulator for ITP. BTK has been around for a number of diseases. And the question is that how do you sort of optimally use these, because they have had variabilities in their ability to actually work. Things that work in CLL may not work as well in lymphoma. There are efforts to target BCL2, which is a common translocated gene, using venetoclax. They're MDM2 inhibitors. And then there's epigenetic modifications. So EZH2 is a polyclonal protein. It's a general repressor of transcription. It's pretty important in development. And so there have been efforts to target EZH2 because it's mutated in about 15 to 20% of patients. That is interesting because one of the agent, the temozolomide, which is the primary agent out there, was just put on an FDA hold because for another disease that was being tried, and the patient developed a secondary lymphoma. So the other is what about the tumor microenvironment? The microenvironment is important in every single cancer. So there's a lot of interest in using lenalidomide to target. There is activity with some checkpoint inhibitors. And then there are things like stimulating NK cells, or CD47 is the story from Irv Weissman's lab, where you sort of block the signal that doesn't allow cells to be consumed. So these are really the sort of strategies in these three big buckets, and that's all sort of pervasive throughout lymphoma therapy, but these are some examples of what people are working on. So I think questions for follicular lymphoma are, you know, can you go ahead and actually use other antibodies besides Rituxan? So Rituxan's been used. There is some evidence that obinutuzumab gives you more activity than rituximab. I think everyone is thinking that at some point you can give people active therapy without giving them chemotherapy. So that's a big goal. And then another question, you know, is can you figure out exactly what's going to work in these people? So things like EZH2 inhibition work much, much better if you have a mutation than if you don't in follicular lymphoma. What about consolidation and maintenance? I think one question is like, how do you sort of balance this issue of PFS versus OS, right? So PFS is a surrogate for OS, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it equates OS, right? So in this situation, when you're treating someone who doesn't necessarily have symptomatic disease, are you doing them any favors by pushing the time to disease, you know, relapse? And myeloma clearly at some point improves overall survival, makes you live longer, but that has really not been, I think, well documented in indolent lymphoma. And then in the relapse refractory disease, everyone's pointing towards immunotherapy. I think that really the biggest thing in the field right now is you have all of these agents, and so can you combine them in, you know, in sort of novel ways? And so that it brings out logistical, and it brings out scientific, and brings out clinical issues. And so logistically, you know, if you're a company that has two types of agents, you can combine them together, hopefully, probably. If you have two different companies, then how do you get them to work together? I think in myeloma, Ken has been great at actually getting companies to work together, and so we have all these great combinations. It's been a little bit harder, I think, in lymphoma. And can you do it in a scientifically rational way? Because at some point, you know, it's hard to model follicular lymphoma, and it ends up being empiric, and can you actually sort stuff out? So I think that the last thing is, you know, what are the optimal endpoints? Is it, you know, is it response rate? Is it progression-free survival? And so I think it depends on sort of where you are in the natural history of the disease. So for large cell lymphoma, it's pretty easy. Everybody gets R-CHOP. Some people get radiation, although that is less and less frequent. And then when you relapse, if you unfortunately aren't cured, so R-CHOP has been the king, and the reason why it's been the king is because it actually cures people. So it's very difficult to displace something that has cured it, right? So if you really, really want to make a difference, you should cure more people, right? And that would be improving the overall survival. So here, R-CHOP has sort of been the king. If you look at when patients relapse, you know, at this point in time, there's really nothing approved. And I think this surprises people because they say, look, there's got to be a bunch of agents in that space. But really, the only two things that have been approved are CAR T-cells, and that's been very recently. There's a lot of different chemotherapy you can use. There are other things that, you know, you can use off-label. But really, I think that space will open up. There's a question of whether or not people should go to autologous transplant or not. It used to be the standard. The people who relapse now after R-CHOP have really bad lymphoma, and it's unclear that just dose intensification with the transplant does anything. So we at Hopkins have been pushing doing allo transplants. In terms of novel agents, you have the same thing. You have things that are targeting cell surface. You have things that are targeting B-cell receptor signaling. There's some data that maybe selinexor and XPO1 inhibition may be important. Here again, BCL2 and EZH2 are being looked at. There are efforts with checkpoint, CAR T-cells, and so here I think that the sobering thing is that aside from CAR T-cells, really nothing gives you this incredible response rate. Most are like within the 40 to 50% range. The progression-free survival off of those agents is pretty low. People have not really explored combination therapies here, and so I think that might be one way to get around that. And I think that, you know, looking at sort of why CAR T cells fail, I think that opens up a lot of avenues for combining different things. So, you know, here again, how do you bring new agents into the first line therapy if you have something that's curative? It's difficult to do that trial. Can you figure out, you know, precision approaches? You can divide up large B-cell lymphoma into a couple different subgroups. Should you do maintenance? Maintenance has failed with rituximab. I think maintenance probably fails with Revlimid. So if you have a super aggressive tumor, does maintenance actually make sense? It does in ALL, in kids with ALL, but it doesn't really in AML. It is questionable whether it happens. It works at all in large cell lymphoma. And then in the relapse refractory situation, Ken touched on this. I think that CAR T cells are what we have, but we don't know how long they're durable, right? And what are the mechanisms of escape? You know, what are the optimal endpoints? It's really like response rate to some extent with CAR T cells. And so should that be the new bar? And then how should we approach transplantation? The final thing is Hodgkin's lymphoma. It's very curable, so everyone gets ABVD. There's the Echelon 1 data that suggests that giving brentuximab with ABVD improves progression-free survival, but there's no difference in overall survival. You maybe can tease that out if we wait long enough and if we're still alive by that time. If you relapse, there's a couple of agents that I think are pretty interesting. One is brentuximab, which has been heavily used with or without a transplant. And then really in heme malignancies, I would argue that the only place that anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibition has worked is really in Hodgkin's lymphoma. And people have not figured out exactly why that is. So there are a bunch of novel agents. I think here you have HDAC inhibition, which has seemed promising early on. There's JAK signaling here. There are efforts to do CAR T cells. And then about 40% of patients have they carry EBV with them in their lymphoma. So there's efforts to target that. And then in Hodgkin's, you know, how do we bring new things in? Should be PFS thing to bring it in. Should we do any maintenance, you know, maintenance after an autologous transplant? It's made a difference in PFS. It hasn't in OS. And what do we do about relapse refractory disease? There are efforts to combine these things, just like in large cell lymphoma, so I think that that's good. Here, I think, you know, the role of transplantation is you tend to get an autologous transplant, and then if you failed that, you go to an allo transplant. And the question is, can we actually figure out who's going to do poorly up front, so we skip the auto step? So that's sort of, a broad overview of, like, these three sort of entities in lymphoma. What do we do for them? What should we be doing for them? What are new things in them? So I think that the one thing about lymphoma is that it has got a ton of novel agents in it. And so I think that it is just a matter of time that you break these barriers of getting things for relapse refractory large cell lymphoma or finding things that help, you know, do induction therapy, carry out induction therapy without any chemo in follicular lymphoma, which would be great. So that is it.
Thanks, Bill. Okay, so I counted on my hand about 8 different diseases that we really talked about. I think we have about 167 or so more to talk about if anybody wants to come up. I guess, and you know, from the descriptions of what you described, they all have their unique challenges. They're very diverse spaces. But can we talk about maybe identifying some common themes? Are there common challenges that you have with dealing with patients with these various heme malignancies across the space that could be, you know, potentially applied more broadly across patient populations?
Yeah, I think that in the case of, you know, in myeloma, there's been such a good job combining things, right? And part of that is that you can do that because many of the things are not totally toxic, right? If you think about things like large cell lymphoma or Hodgkin's disease, the chemo that you give up front that is curative is really pretty toxic, right? So I think it becomes hard to sort of add in. But I think that if you are bringing things in that, let's say, brentuximab and replacing bleomycin, which has lung toxicity, with brentuximab, which maybe has some neurotoxicity, you know, I think trade-offs occur, and, you know, the question is, can you improve outcomes by doing those strategies? But I think that in many cases, the paradigm of combining things, like I think in myeloid diseases, we've not done a good job combining much with anything either. So I think efforts to sort of target TGF-beta signaling as well as like epigenetics, let's say, is a great way of sort of doing that. But like, I think myeloma was really at the forefront of overlaying multiple MOAs, and can we do that in other diseases? Because I think that that's really where, you know, strategies should move to.
Is there something unique about myeloma, do you think, that, you know, led to that? You know, is it just that you had more collaborative people, or is there something about the nature of the disease that, you know, led to the evolution of combination regimens more easily?
I think that it's the people are great in myeloma, the people are great in lymphoma, and people are great in AML. I think that one is that you have a lot of different MOAs that are all don't have massive toxicities, right? And I think that a lot of groundwork was done to try to figure out what would be rational combinations, let's say in the lab, before taking them to the clinic. And I think that that was also a pretty important part of it. And a lot of, you know, in lymphoma, there's no Hodgkin's disease model, there's no follicular lymphoma model, there's no MALT lymphoma, you know, none of these things. So I think it's a little bit harder to model in the lab. So it ends up being somewhat empirical over time.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that there are common themes across the heme malignancies. What I think one important one is that since they are heme malignancies, they're the value and importance of the microenvironment, whether it be in a lymph node, whether it be in the bone marrow, et cetera. And you heard beautifully from Stan about novel agents now. They're going to restore a red cell differentiation and production in the context of an abnormal garden or soil. And I think that in multiple myeloma, many of the agents that we use target not only the tumor and the microenvironment. So I do think as we go forward that there will be, there already are, and there will be mechanisms. The phenotypes will be different, but many of the pathways will be the same. I'll cite, for example, one very exciting class of agents that you have already heard about targeting BCL2 or anti-apoptotic proteins, venetoclax being the paradigm explored first and being very successful in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, but now being used in some lymphomas, Bill, and AML, Stan, in multiple myeloma. So the idea that there are common pathways that might mediate growth survival and drug resistance on the one hand in many of the heme malignancies, and then on the other side, the same pathways, whether it be, could be targeted in terms of the anti-apoptotic proteins or the BCL2 family. There may be different ones, so maybe BCL2 is more important in some lymphomas, and maybe MCL1 is more important in myeloma, but the concepts of blocking growth survival or drug resistance or triggering apoptosis, and then the combination, I think, is very common themes.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things is common themes of where we failed. So there has been a vast amount of investment in the immune checkpoint inhibitor space in the hematologic malignancies, and with the exception of Hodgkin's lymphoma, where there's incredible biology in chromosome 9 that makes it a rational therapy, the results overall have been disappointing. It's not for lack of trying, and it's been where there was lab data that suggested it was a rational combination and we would hope to see dramatic activity, but for the most part it's been fairly disappointing. So we keep looking for those common themes where they might exist, and for agents that have a broader play. I think the comment on the apoptotic pathway is one where two decades ago we started looking at BCL2 and we had programs in CLL, AML, and myeloma, and they all failed, and probably failed because the drug wasn't good enough, not because the pathway wasn't good enough. And the venetoclax data is highly provocative, and agents coming along, as Ken mentioned, for MCL1 may have broader applicability just beyond myeloma, but we'll have to see, and that's where they're being tested first in the heme malignancies. The epigenetics would be another one where we've tried. Clearly there are several HDAC inhibitors that have gotten labels now in either myeloma, in the case of panobinostat, or in lymphomas, romidepsin, vorinostat, belinostat. So there are some of these common themes, but they just haven't hit the same amount of pay dirt as we might find. There have sort of been incremental advances when they've come. One of the challenges in the myeloid diseases is just the complexity of the genetics. So we're very gratified that IDH2 has been effectively targeted, and our colleagues at Agios are well along in trying to see if IDH1 targeting will also have the same sort of clinical benefit. But short of FLT3 inhibitors, which might have some incremental benefit, we haven't really been able to find that Achilles heel that's broadly applicable. And as I sort of tell the medical students, is that we give diseases names not because that's the biology. We give them names because that's how we think about it. And the way we thought about acute myeloid leukemia starting 40 or 50 years ago was one disease, and now we know it's 1,000. So how do we treat each of those 1,000 diseases, not just the AML, has been the challenge.
Yeah, I would mention one other quick thing. I do think the genetic complexity is both constitutively and ongoing quite a challenge in the heme malignancies, because we have ongoing DNA damage and clonal evolution in our diseases. That, to me, argues for two principles. One, to try to go as early as we can, to try to target as soon as we can identify the disease. So you hear about very early screening, for example, for monoclonal proteins, or even the concept that isn't yet disease, but of clonal hematopoiesis, where we all, as we become more mature, end up having clonal hematopoiesis, which in some patients correlates with MDS or lymphoma or myeloma, but in other patients correlates with heart disease or autoimmune disease or Alzheimer's, cardiac disease. The point is, I think that there are going to be very high levels of genetic complexity. Having said that, I think that will suggest common mechanisms if we can understand what underlies these complexities, the processes that are actually responsible. In cancer, APABEC is markedly elevated and probably guilty in terms of some of this constitutive and ongoing DNA genetic evolution. But I think it also, to me, says it's such a complicated genetics to start with, and it's continually a moving target. It pushes me back towards the immune therapies. And I do think there's still much to be learned there, whether it be vaccines, whether it be some of the others that I showed you. I particularly like the adoptive immunotherapy approach, where we might be able to get in patients memory cell responses against their own cancer. But be that as it may, remember, in the solid tumors, the lesson from melanoma and other solid tumors is the more genetic complexity, the more they apparently respond to checkpoint inhibitors. So we need to figure out in the hematologic space how we can restore the microenvironment that then in turn allows response to checkpoint inhibitors and other immune therapies. I totally agree with Stan. It has been very frustrating in terms of the first generation PD-1s, et cetera. But I think that there is still is some opportunity for combination of immune approaches, augmenting an antibody, augmenting a vaccine, augmenting CAR T cells, et cetera, so that we can have a more long-lasting benefit.
Yeah, and that was a common theme, even the earlier panels, you know, talking about breast cancer, and you know, the biomarker panel talking about, you know, the ability to identify, you know, disease early and intervene with, and being able to sort out who you might be overtreating versus who really will benefit from the therapy.
Yes. I mean, I'll just mention one quick thing. It's a little bit off from the topic, but I think, you know, as you've heard, at least so in the myeloma space, we have lots of novel agents now. And so how are we going to go forward as a community to continue the progress? One approach is to come along with new agents and try to test only those patients who have failed every other treatment. And that has been undertaken. The selinexor model is there, and there's a very low response rate that lasts a very short time, and it may get approved. But to me, it argues for two things. One is to really, once one gets relapsed disease, to go very much earlier in the disease, and in fact do randomized trials against the standard of care, phase two, perhaps smaller numbers of trials, to do profiled trials, that is, where there's a biomarker, where there's a target, a small number of patients. But one topic I think that crosses all of our heme malignancies and more broadly is to someday to have, for lack of a better term, registries where we actually have clinically annotated, genomically profiled large databases so that when novel agents come along from companies or from academia or wherever they come from, instead of us taking the time to do large phase one, phase two, phase three, hundreds of patients, hundreds of millions of dollars, and more importantly, too many years, that we someday can just say, here is the standard of practice, and here is the clinical expected outcome in 2025 in this particular patient population, and you come along with a new thing from Celgene that looks really very different, and we don't have to waste all the time and money in order to get that to patients more quickly. So I know there's a lot of efforts in this regard, and in this room, I'm sure, too, to construct such large databases. But I think it's so key to understand the diseases, to understand the outcomes, but also to get drug approval. And the final thing I'll say is, since we all have had such progress in our diseases, we need to develop biomarkers and or surrogate markers, and in our disease, it's MRD. And the reason I just mentioned it now, we need to learn how to use it clinically, but for the purposes of new drug development, we desperately need to have minimal residual disease as a regulatory endpoint. If we actually go as we have in the past with progression-free survival, which might approach 7 to 10 years or longer, and you come along with a novel agent and you're required to make it 30% or 50% longer, it's totally not doable. We can't wait a decade for clinical trials. So we're very active and proactive with our regulatory colleagues to try to get the database amassed that exists now or get it through ongoing trials so that we can have a MRD endpoint perhaps at 18 months that would predict for benefit per PFS or OS 10 years later. Once that happens, we can really move along much more quickly in terms of novel agents.
Wait, why has it been so challenging to validate MRD, and not just in myeloma and other patient populations? I mean, there are, you know, a handful of malignancies where, you know, it's standard of care, but, you know, largely it's been difficult to validate in some of the areas.
I think that MRD is super contextual, right? So if you said, what does MRD mean in a person who's newly diagnosed versus a person who's multiply relapsed, it probably doesn't give you the same output, right? So in general, in many chronic diseases, let's say lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, the degree of the depth of response may or may not correlate with how people do long term. And I think part of it is that the way that you get to MRD is super important, right? So if you, let's say you have CML and you treat with Gleevec, and you manage to get an incredibly good depth of response, right? And let's say you're negative. Well, if you stop in those patients, most of them are going to relapse, right? So MRD achievement in MRD doesn't mean that you're cured. If you get MRD negativity after a bone marrow transplant for CML, right, then there's a very high likelihood that the patient's not going to relapse with CML. So you're achieving the same depth, but you took two roads to get there, and the roads you took actually make a difference. And so I think it may be challenging to take things out of context and just say, look, we're just achieving this mark. I think that might be a challenge moving forward. I think that everything points towards, in many diseases, that you improve outcomes by looking at MRD, but I think the way you do it, can it be standardized? Can you use it clinically in the right context because you should use it where it was generated? Then I think that all makes sense. But I think it's tough because the technology to do it is changing quickly, and once you have a set of data, it's hard to know. Well, what does it mean moving forward? I think that's the really difficult part.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to take some questions.
Some drugs, and I'm pointing this out particularly to Stan, where I just don't think they're going to make it as single therapies.
backwards.
So I think in terms of sequencing, it's hard to know what to do with the information, right? Like, I think that you can sequence on a very broad level to understand, let's say, hopefully understand the pathogenesis of the disease better. I think that if you have a patient in front of you and they bring a hard drive from somewhere that has all of their data, the question is, you know, are there ways that you can leverage that to sort of personalize therapy? I think as Ken was saying, I think we'll get there at some point. But you need, like, multiple data points. You need data points about what the mutations are. You need data points about what the treatment is. You need data point about what the patient has done with that therapy. So you need a ton of points of data. And I think that getting small bits of data are helpful to some extent to sort of blanket everything. But this N of one issue, I think, is helpful and non-helpful. Like, I think that you can see some things, but most of the time it doesn't work. So
will sequencing become routine at diagnosis?
I think it will. I think it will, at least at a very some level, it'll help you molecularly define certain diseases. And as we learn about them, maybe you can prognosticate a little bit better. But I right now, I think it's very hard to sit across the desk from a patient and say, oh, your sequencing shows this, so this is what we're going to do. I haven't found that necessarily super useful.
Yeah, no, I think it will become routine. It is routine in many places. So new patients in our center do get targeted sequencing done. I think, you know, in hemolignancies, there have been huge success stories. So hairy cell leukemia with the BRAF, you know, is slightly curable with venurafimib or similar agents. So it's been a home run. But in many cases, we're just learning. EZH2 is perhaps the first epigenetic therapy in hemolignancies that's come to the bedside. So I think inevitably it will translate. I think we have to build, as your question implies, a sufficient database in order to understand where to use this. And one of the things I always like to think about is I used to be the editor of Clinical Cancer Research, which is a mostly solid tumor journal, and I'm not mostly solid tumor. And I used to watch and see how what's new is old and what's old is new, going back between solid tumors and hemolignancies with the same pathways and the same mechanisms, different phenotypes. But your example of dual inhibition, you know, don't use a single, you know, BRAF inhibitor. You need to block the escape routes at the same time. That might have been learned in melanoma, but we need to use it in hemolignancies in the same way. And I think the more that we can learn from this, and, you know, the ultimate will be we'll have pathway-driven treatments and things that will transcend hemolignancies and solid tumors. And the final thing is, I do think most of the lessons from in cancer did come from hematologic malignancies, starting with ALL, the principles of chemotherapy and combinations, et cetera. So we can learn both ways. I think the immunology lessons are probably coming a lot from the solid tumors back towards the hemolignancies.
So that said, I think we're just about out of time, but I just wanted to ask the panel, just kind of go down one by one, of all the things that, all the diseases or patients that you manage that you find particularly challenging with high unmet needs that, you know, that you believe that, you know, better drug treatment, better diagnosis, whatever. Maybe you could just point out, you know, a couple examples one by one as we go down, and maybe we can continue this discussion in the cocktail hour later on today.
So I think that the treating patients who are elderly is tough, right? I think that's where novel therapies really make their mark. And so patients with elderly AML, it's really tough to treat them. Patients with elderly patients with Hodgkin's disease, they have a curable disease, but they can't tolerate the chemotherapy. That's really hard. And so I think that for me, taking care of older individuals is a challenge, especially if you put them in the confines of what we normally treat that disease with. I think it's really tough. And the population's growing older, and they're more and more.
So I would put it to what do we aspire to do? And
as a physician, I would aspire to have a therapy that is affordable, does not totally stop the patient's life to go through that therapy, and that's both in terms of intensity of treatment, but also time. So being on a chronic course of therapy for ALL for 3 years, you might be cured, but that's very different than being able to come in and get your therapy in a month and get the same results. So, you know, we sort of take the paradigm of where we've learned from the science. And it can be acute promyelocytic leukemia, it can be hairy cell leukemia. We're learning more about myeloma. We've now understood the B-cell receptor pathways. But the cellular therapy approaches, if they truly have durability, will change how we treat these diseases in a way that we just are scratching the surface of now, because it's not 10 lines of therapy, but maybe it's one. And we aren't there yet. We don't have the durability. And as we talked earlier, it's probably not this generation of the constructs that are going to get there. But I think that that's part of why we're making the play as we are in cellular therapies, while we are still trying to have better supportive care agents, address symptoms and address the biology. The other comment I wanted to get to was one Ken made, and that is on the how we do trials and discovery better. And this concept of a synthetic control group will not be a trivial one. Some of this is coming through investments in electronic medical records and being able to annotate and now having increasing computing power on the cloud. But this is something that we are taking very seriously as a way of accelerating trials. And the regulators have started the discussions with us, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, I would say that, just to echo, I do think that the large-scale databases, internationally large-scale databases, will not only expedite new drug development, but they'll give us a feeling for what it is that is going on in the world in terms of the state of different diseases. How are they treated? What's the good news? What are the side effects, et cetera? For me, the future is, I think, to be honest, drugs that target, as I call them, Achilles heels. So in myeloma, we targeted protein degradation, which turns out to be an Achilles heel. I think there's a whole new class of drugs coming that actually turn on protein degradation, that get rid of the abnormal substrate that can be implicated in the pathogenesis of the disease. And we have a lot of hope for those if, in fact, that can happen, because maybe we won't have to worry so much about the ongoing mutations, et cetera, if we get rid of proteins that actually are causative for the disease. I think the final point I would make is that although you've heard great progress, and we can all celebrate the progress in cancer in general, what we, though, who still see patients, can tell you every day is we see the patients now who have failed every single agent that is new and still come in and need more treatments. So I just would make a plea that the investment from all different constituencies that are needed to develop new drugs really needs to continue. We can talk about people who have normal lifespans and in some cases have cured individuals, but honestly, the potential has never been greater, but the obligation has never been greater either to make the science that we all represent in this room really count for patients.
Great. Well, thank you. On that note, I think we will conclude. Thank you.